We've been going through the book of Revelation on Sunday afternoons, and last time we were in this book, we started a new section of it, something I'm calling season two of the show. We were introduced to a whole new set of developments, new plot lines, a whole new cast of characters, and there was a lot of attention in Revelation 12 given to this great red dragon. He was explicitly identified for us as that ancient serpent who is called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. And we noticed how this great red dragon was standing in front of a woman who was in labor. And as we worked through the text, we saw how the devil failed to prevent the Messiah from being born. He failed to prevent the Savior of the world from coming. He failed to prevent the Savior of the world from accomplishing his purpose. And now, in his fury, he is pursuing the people of God in great wrath, knowing that his time is short. And so when we finished off in chapter 12 last time, we saw him pursuing this woman in the wilderness, and the woman at this point represents the church, the people of God, as we go through this life looking forward to the time when we will be in the promised land forever. But the dragon does what people do when they know that they're losing. He starts exhausting all of the resources that he has. And in chapter 13 and chapter 14, we will be introduced to the three main allies that the dragon recruits. And the first one is here in Revelation chapter 13, verses 1 through 10, an entity that we will call the sea beast. So let's go ahead and read that, Revelation chapter 13, verses 1 through 10. And I saw a beast rising out of the sea with 10 horns and 7 heads, with 10 diadems on its horns and a blasphemous name on its heads, and blasphemous names on its heads. And the beast that I saw was like a leopard. Its feet were like a bear's, and its mouth was like a lion's mouth. And to it the dragon gave his power and his throne and great authority. One of its heads seemed to have a mortal wound, but its mortal wound was healed, and the whole earth marveled as they followed the beast. And they worshiped the dragon, for he had given his authority to the beast. And they worshiped the beast, saying, "Who is like the beast, and who can fight against it?" And the beast was given a mouth uttering haughty and blasphemous words, and it was allowed to exercise authority for 42 months. It opened its mouth to utter blasphemies against God, blaspheming the name and his dwelling, that is, those who dwell in heaven. Also, it was allowed to make war on the saints and to conquer them. And authority was given it over every tribe and people and language and nation, and all who dwell on earth will worship it. Everyone whose name has not been written before the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb who was slain. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. If anyone is to be taken captive, to captivity he goes. If anyone is to be slain with the sword must he be slain. Here is a call for the endurance and faith of the saints. Now, if you remember in chapter 12, we ended with the dragon standing on the sand of the sea. And now chapter 13 opens with this beast rising out of the sea. And like the dragon, the beast has 10 horns and 7 heads. So they've got some qualities in common. But unlike the dragon, this beast is described like this terrifying amalgamation of animals. He's described as part leopard, part bear, and part lion. So what's going on here? Well, if you are a good Old Testament student, you'll know exactly what's going on here. This is a hyperlink straight back to Daniel chapter 7. So let's go ahead and turn back to Daniel chapter 7 and see if that'll help us to understand what we're reading here in Revelation 13. And just to set a little bit of the context, remember, Daniel was a prophet who prophesied during the Babylonian captivity. And he prophesied beginning in the days of the Babylonian Empire. In Daniel chapter 2, it was the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar who had a dream. And in that dream, he dreamed of a statue that had four different parts. And God gave the interpretation of that dream to Daniel, who then gave the interpretation to Nebuchadnezzar. And he told Nebuchadnezzar that he, the first kingdom, was represented by the first part of that statue, which was the head of gold. But then the other three parts of that statue would represent three more kingdoms that would come after Babylon. And God said that in the days of the fourth kingdom, he would set up a kingdom that would never be destroyed. Now, in Daniel chapter 7, Daniel has a vision, but it's not of a statue with four parts. It's of four different animals, four different beasts. But Daniel's vision in Daniel 7 is parallel to Nebuchadnezzar's dream in Daniel 2. The four animals represent the four kingdoms that were represented by the four parts of the statue earlier. And it becomes very clear by the time you get to the end of Daniel chapter 8 that these four beasts, these four parts of the statue, these four kingdoms are in fact Babylon, Persia, Greece, and Rome. Those would be the four world powers that are under discussion: Babylon, Persia, Greece, and Rome. So knowing that, let's look at the way Daniel sees this depicted in Daniel chapter 7, verses 1 through 8. Daniel 7, beginning in verse 1. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream and visions of his head as he lay in his bed. Then he wrote down the dream and told the sum of the matter. Daniel declared, "I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. And four great beasts came up out of the sea, different from one another. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. Then as I looked, its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and the mind of a man was given to it. And behold, another beast, a second one, like a bear. It was raised up on one side, it had three ribs in its mouth between its teeth, and it was told, 'Arise, devour much flesh.' After this I looked, and behold, another, like a leopard, with four wings of a bird on its back. And the beast had four heads, and dominion was given to it. After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, terrifying and dreadful and exceedingly strong. It had great iron teeth. It devoured and broke in pieces and stamped what was left with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another horn, a little one, before which three of the first horns were plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things." Okay, so let's just kind of take stock of what we've read so far. Here in Daniel chapter 7, Daniel sees a vision of four beasts. The first kingdom is represented by a lion, the second by a bear, the third by a leopard, and the fourth is some kind of monster with 10 horns that defies description or explanation. Now, as each world power rose to prominence in history, it would swallow up the kingdom that came before it. And what Daniel is seeing here in this vision is a representation of that, that each subsequent kingdom comes and it swallows up the kingdom that's before it. And so when he gets to this fourth kingdom, it just defies description. But notice that the same four animals are represented in Revelation 13. In Revelation 13, Daniel, or John, sees this beast that is part lion, part bear, part leopard, but in the end, a monster with 10 horns that defies description. So what Revelation 13 is depicting for us is the fulfillment of what Daniel predicted. It is the fulfillment of what he foresaw nearly 600 years before. The days of the fourth kingdom have come. It is the days of the Roman Empire. And so we should think about them when we think about this beast rising out of the sea. Now, there's a few other things that we should notice about this beast in Revelation 13. Verse 5 tells us that the beast was given a mouth uttering haughty and blasphemous words. That was characteristic of one of those horns in Daniel chapter 7. And we'll come back to that later on in the book of Revelation. But what else is characteristic of this beast is this propensity to blasphemy. This egotistical, braggadocious kind of mentality. That's what characterizes this monster, this empire. And verses 3 and 4 of Revelation 13 tell us that the whole earth came to marvel at the beast and worship it. But it says here that one of its heads seemed to have a mortal wound, but its mortal wound was healed. And that's how the whole earth marvels as they follow the beast. Verse 4 says, they worship the beast, for he had they worship the dragon, for he had given his authority to the beast. And they worship the beast, saying, who is like the beast, and who can fight against it? Now, you have to understand from a first century perspective just how impressive the Roman Empire was. It was unlike anything that had come before it. There had been other world powers that had risen and fallen. As we've read in Daniel 7, there was Babylon that was followed by Persia, that was followed by Greece. But none of those three kingdoms that came before the Roman Empire was nearly as well organized or expansive or powerful as it was. And so for people who saw the Roman Empire rise to power, they were in awe. It was unlike anything the world had ever seen before. But there was a time fairly early on in the history of the Roman Empire when it seemed like it was starting to fall apart. That was the year 69 AD. 69 AD was known as the year of the four emperors. And the reason why is because it followed the death of Emperor Nero. Nero committed suicide, and after he died, he left the reigns of the empire in disarray. There was a period of brief civil war, and there were four different empires who tried to, four different emperors, who all seized the throne in less than 1 year. Out of those four, two of them were murdered, and one of them committed suicide. And so, from the perspective of somebody living in the first century, it would appear like the mighty Roman Empire was just starting to fall apart. It looked like it was collapsing and dying. But as Revelation 13 tells us, its mortal wound was healed. The fourth emperor during that year of the four emperors was the Roman Emperor Vespasian. He became emperor at the end of 69 AD, and when he stabilized the Roman Empire, he made it stronger than ever. And so, that's what caused the world to marvel at the beast and to worship it. They saw what they thought was a mortal wound. They saw what they thought was the crumbling of this great empire, but then it came back stronger than ever. And you can imagine the way people would have thought about that. If the Roman Empire can survive civil war and come back even stronger, then surely this must be a kingdom that will last forever. And so the dragon takes advantage of that situation. Verse 7 of Revelation 13 tells us, it was allowed to make war on the saints and to conquer them. The dragon's first ally is persecution. I think that's what we ought to see here. The first ally that the dragon recruits is persecution. In the first century, he used the military might of the Roman Empire to bring persecution to the saints. And in the century since, he's used many other ways to do that. But one of Satan's strongest tools, one of his most effective tools, has always been persecution and intimidation. And when we are persecuted or intimidated, what we need to do is to be able to endure it. That's what verse 10 says. Verse 10 says, here is a call for the endurance and faith of the saints. And so now we've seen the dragon's first ally and the first response. Well, now we're ready to see the dragon's second ally, and we'll keep reading here in Revelation 13, verses 11 through 18. Then I saw another beast rising out of the earth. It had two horns like a lamb, and it spoke like a dragon. It exercises all the authority of the first beast in its presence, and makes the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast, whose mortal wound was healed. It performs great signs, even making fire come down from heaven to earth in front of people. And by the signs that it is allowed to work in the presence of the beast, it deceives those who dwell on earth, telling them to make an image for the beast that was wounded by the sword and yet lived. And it was allowed to give breath to the image of the beast, so that the image of the beast might even speak and might cause those who would not worship the image of the beast to be slain. Also, it causes all, both small and great, both rich and poor, both free and slave, to be marked on the right hand or the forehead, so that no one can buy or sell unless he has the mark, that is, the name of the beast or the number of its name. This calls for wisdom. Let the one who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. Okay, so now the second beast rises out of the earth. So we can call the first beast the sea beast, and we'll call the second one the land beast. Notice that it has two horns like a lamb, but it speaks like a dragon. You know, Jesus warned about wolves in sheep's clothing. This is a dragon in lamb's clothing. And his mission is to get all the inhabitants of the earth to worship the first beast. And in order to do that, he uses his own versions of signs and wonders. Some of the things that it describes might remind you of some of the things that we've read earlier in the book. Remember, one of those two witnesses in chapter 11 could call fire down from heaven, and this land beast tries to mimic the same thing. And in the process, he's able to deceive large numbers of people. In Revelation 16 and verse 13, we'll see this beast again, and he'll be called by a different name. He'll actually be called the false prophet there. And so now we know what the dragon's second ally is. The dragon's second ally is false teaching or deception. And in the first century, he used the religious aspect of the Roman Empire to attack the saints. The first Roman emperor who declared himself a god, the one who claimed divinity and demanded worship, was Caligula. And Caligula reigned from 37 AD to 41 AD. And from the time of Caligula onwards, worship of the Roman emperors became more and more common. By the end of the first century, every one of those seven cities that had the seven churches of Asia actually had temples dedicated to the deity of Caesar. And so that tells us something about the way this emperor worship developed and spread throughout the world where this book was being written. But this became common practice. The worship of the imperial cult spread until the 4th century. And the pressure to worship the Roman emperors and the Roman Empire became so great that it was basically required for any kind of semblance of normal life. If you were going to fit into the Roman Empire, if you were going to function economically, you would have to worship what you were told to worship. And so this religious aspect, this imperial cult, that became a strong force against the Christians. I'll just take a moment to observe with you here that we ought to be skeptical when governments take on a religious aspect. Historically, that has been a tool for manipulation and not for righteousness or for justice. And here we see the Roman government taking on this religious aspect that becomes compulsory for everybody. And that's really what this mark of the beast is about. It's this social pressure that comes to conform to false religion. And there will be cases where the saints have to decide what's most important to them. Is it to fit in with the culture and the society? Is it to go with the flow so that you can continue to prosper economically or physically? Or is it to stand for what's true, to stand for what's right, to resist that and suffer the consequences for it? Now, remember, the way to resist Satan's first ally was endurance. In verse 10, he said, here is a call for the endurance of the saints. When we're faced with persecution, we must endure it. But the way to resist Satan's second ally is wisdom. In verse 18, he says, this calls for wisdom. Let the one who has understanding calculate the number of the beast. For it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. So, just notice here, we've got two of the dragon's allies. The first is persecution. The way to face that is with endurance. The second is false religion or deception. The way to counter that is with wisdom. And he says that if you have wisdom, you ought to calculate the number of the beast, which has given rise to all kinds of colorful conversations, hasn't it? What is that about? The number of the beast is 666. This is one of those times where we could invest a lot of time going through all the different ideas that people have and why I think that they're not right, but we won't do that. Instead, I'll just mention one, though. One very common understanding of this is that it refers to the Emperor Nero. It's true that if you do some very creative math and you translate back and forth in different languages and creatively arrange some things, you can try to make 666 spell out Caesar Nero or Nero Caesar. I'm not at all convinced by that. I don't think that's the point. In the context of the book, 7 is the number that consistently refers to completeness. 7 refers to God in his perfection, in his wholeness. By contrast, the number 6 would be representative of a failure. It's a failure to measure up to the completeness of God. And so, it's just a failed imitation of God's completeness and perfection. I think what this is telling us is that the one who has understanding will be able to see the false teaching of the beast for what it is. It tries to mimic the perfection of God. It tries to measure up to the completeness of God. And yet, the reality is, it is failure, failure, failure. That's the point. Foolish people will be deceived by false teachers who look like a lamb or perform great signs. They'll be deceived by politicians who are self-centered and self-serving. They'll be deceived by teachers who are false and self-centered. But wise people will be able to discern the voice of the dragon when they hear it. Now, at this point, the scene changes. If you remember before, we've had interludes in the book where we've been following the narrative and then suddenly we have a scene change. And that's the case as we move into chapter 14. In chapter 14, he says, "Then I looked, and behold, on Mount Zion stood the Lamb, and with him 144,000 who had his name and his father's name written on their foreheads. And I heard a voice from heaven, like the roar of many waters and like the sound of loud thunder. The voice I heard was like the sound of harpists playing on their harps. And they were singing a new song before the throne and before the four living creatures and before the elders. No one could learn that song except the 144,000 who had been redeemed from the earth. It is these who have not defiled themselves with women, for they are virgins. It is these who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. These have been redeemed from mankind as first fruits for God and the Lamb. And in their mouth no lie was found, for they are blameless." Now, I told you that this is a new season of the show, and there's new plot lines and new characters, but there is continuity with season one. And we have seen the Lamb before. Remember, he appeared in Revelation 4 and 5 there in that throne room scene in heaven. And we've also seen the 144,000 before. They appeared in chapter 7, where they were sealed for protection on earth. But it's interesting that now, here in Revelation 14, we see them together. In Revelation 4 and 5, the Lamb was in heaven. In Revelation 7, the 144,000 were on earth. They were being sealed for protection there before God's judgment came. And so now we're seeing heaven and earth being connected. We're seeing the Lamb and the 144,000 dwelling together. And what we call that location, that intersection, that overlap of heaven and earth, is Mount Zion. So what's that about? Well, Mount Zion represents the overlap of heaven and earth. Because in the Old Testament, Zion was the name of a hill in Jerusalem where the temple was built. So in the Old Testament, when God's temple was built, it was built on an actual physical place called Mount Zion. But as the people continued to think about the significance of that, it began to take on more and more of a spiritual significance. That was the place where God dwelt. And in the Old Testament, the prophets continued to talk about Mount Zion in increasingly spiritual ways. They looked forward to a time when God would actually dwell with his people in a new kingdom in the days of the Messiah. They looked to a time when God's people would flow upwards to this mountain. And I want you to see what is said about all of this in Hebrews chapter 12. Hebrews chapter 12, starting in verse 22. Here, this is being written to Christians. And it says, "You have come to Mount Zion, and to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, and to innumerable angels in festal gathering, and to the assembly of the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven, and to God, the judge of all, and to the spirits of the righteous made perfect, and to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood that speaks a better word than the blood of Abel." So when the Hebrews writer talks about what we have come to as Christians, he describes it as coming to Mount Zion, coming to the assembly of the firstborn, coming to what is essentially the intersection of heaven and earth. Though we live here on earth, we have fellowship with the Lamb and with all of the scenes in heaven. And so for us, that is the church. The church is the kingdom of heaven on earth. Mount Zion is where heaven and earth intersect. The 144,000 who are sealed by God, remember that's a figurative number, we talked about that earlier, but it represents all of the people living on earth who have fellowship with the Lamb, who dwell in his presence. Now, in Revelation 14, those saints are pictured standing with the Lamb, hearing the voice of God, surrounded by this heavenly music, singing a new song that no one else on earth could learn. But it also emphasizes the way that they're living their lives. They're dedicated to sexual purity. They're dedicated to moral purity. And the reason why is because it says they follow the Lamb wherever he goes. And isn't that just a beautifully simple way to describe these people? If nothing else could be said about you and the way that you're living your life, if it can be said that you follow the Lamb wherever he goes, that would be a wonderful thing to say. These are those who have been redeemed from mankind as first fruits for God and the Lamb. And so I believe what we're seeing here in Revelation 14, 1 through 5, is a portrait of those who have a heavenly citizenship and the way that their lives are shaped on earth by it. Now, the reason why we've had this interlude is because it's sort of like a boxing match. You know, when you have two heavyweight contenders ready to square off, the guy with the microphone starts by saying, "In this corner, we have this opponent, and in this corner, we have that one." And that's kind of what we've got, is the two opponents ready to square off. The dragon and his allies are in this corner, and the lamb and his allies are in this corner. And so there's this coming conflict. How's it going to go down? Well, we don't have to wonder for long, because chapter 14 ends with three angelic messengers who are not sensitive to spoilers. You might be wondering, how's this going to play out? What's the battle going to be like? Who's going to win? And before you can think about it for very long, three angels tell us exactly what's going to happen. And so let's read that, starting here in verse 6. Revelation 14 and verse 6, John says, "Then I saw another angel flying directly overhead with an eternal gospel to proclaim to those who dwell on earth, to every nation and tribe and language and people. And he said with a loud voice, 'Fear God and give him glory, because the hour of his judgment has come. And worship him who made heaven and earth, the sea and the springs of water.' Another angel, a second, followed, saying, 'Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great, she who made all nations drink the wine of the passion of her sexual immorality.' And another angel, a third, followed them, saying with a loud voice, 'If anyone worships the beast and its image and receives a mark on his forehead or on his hand, he also will drink the wine of God's wrath, poured full strength into the cup of his anger. And he will be tormented with fire and sulfur in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment goes up forever and ever. And they have no rest day or night, these worshipers of the beast and its image, and whoever receives the mark of its name." Now, we haven't properly been introduced to the dragon's third ally yet, but now we already know her fate. In verse 8, it says, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great, she who made all nations drink the wine of the passion of her sexual immorality." We'll read a lot more about her, but Revelation is going ahead and telling us, before we've even been properly introduced, that she's not going to last. In chapter 17, she will be called the Great Prostitute, and she's actually seated on the first beast from chapter 13. So there's quite a scene to picture there, and we'll talk about that later. But we do now know what the dragon's third ally is. Here she is described as someone who has made all nations drink the wine of the passion of her sexual immorality. The dragon's third ally is worldliness or temptation. If Satan can't separate you from God with persecution and intimidation, if he can't do it with false teaching and deception, the third ally at his disposal is worldliness and temptation. He'll try to use that method to separate you from God. Now, this is the first mention of Babylon in the book of Revelation. And throughout the book, Babylon is going to be a reference to Rome. Rome was the Babylon of the first century. Babylon, remember, was the first kingdom. Babylon was the first beast. In some ways, you might think about the four kingdoms as Babylon 1, Babylon 2, Babylon 3, and Babylon 4. Rome is the fourth iteration of Babylon. And like Babylon, like the original Babylon, Rome was known for its military power and for its imperial cult. But it was also known for its decadence and for its immorality. And Christians who lived in the Roman Empire would have been tempted by that sort of thing, by drunkenness, by sexual immorality, by all kinds of sin that was regarded as commonplace and socially acceptable. But the way to resist Satan's third ally is with faithfulness. When we are tempted, we have to decide that we will be faithful to the Lord. Though many will be persuaded to abandon moral virtue, those who follow the Lamb wherever he goes will not defile themselves. They will be those who are committed to purity. So when we look at these verses, verses 6 and 7 show us one angel announcing that judgment is coming to those who refuse the gospel in every nation, tribe, language, and people. In verse 8, a second angel announces that judgment is specifically applied to Babylon. And then in verses 9 through 11, the third angel announces that the beast and all those who worship him will be subject to judgment too. And so verses 12 and 13 conclude. Here is a call for the endurance of the saints, those who keep the commandments of God and their faith in Jesus. And I heard a voice from heaven saying, write this, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. Blessed indeed, says the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors, for their deeds follow them. The key to enduring all of Satan's attacks is really perspective. The difference between those who give in to Satan's attacks and those who resist them are those who are able to maintain the larger perspective, to see what is actually being threatened and what is actually important. Jesus said in Matthew chapter 10 in verse 28, do not fear those who kill the body but cannot kill the soul. Rather, fear him who can destroy both soul and body in hell. So no matter what Satan threatens us with, no matter what ally he recruits, we ought to keep his power in perspective. The worst thing that he can do is kill you. And if you die in Jesus, death will only make you better. So let's conclude this section of the book with three conclusions. The first is that we need endurance against persecution and intimidation. That is Satan's first ally. It is persecution and intimidation. This doesn't mean that we need to go out looking for persecution with some kind of victim complex. This doesn't mean that we need to cry persecution as soon as something unfortunate happens to us. But it does mean that we ought not be surprised when the world lets us know that they reject us. Remember in Acts chapter 14 when Paul was stoned to the point of death? That was in a city called Lystra. But it was directly after that, in Acts 14, 21 and 22, that Paul and Barnabas went through Lystra, Iconium, and Antioch, strengthening the souls of the disciples, encouraging them to continue in the faith, and saying that through many tribulations, we must enter the kingdom of God. Persecution is often the dragon's first ally. And so we ought to expect that we'll have some showdowns with him in our own lives. In Hebrews chapter 10, the Hebrews writer reflects on the persecutions that his readers had experienced. And in Hebrews 10:36, he concludes, "You have need of endurance, so that when you have done the will of God, you may receive what is promised." He goes on to say in chapter 12 and verse 4, "You have not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood." And so although they had faced much temptation, much persecution and intimidation, he says, "You haven't bled yet." And I would imagine that the same is true for most of us. That though we might have experienced some of the pain of rejection or being ostracized or being left out, maybe somebody called us some harsh names, I know that I have not yet resisted to the point of shedding my blood. But whatever the level of persecution or intimidation that we face, we have need of endurance. That's the answer to Satan's first ally. The second is that we need wisdom against false teaching or deception. Remember, in Revelation 13, the land beast looked like a lamb, but he spoke like a dragon. Jesus said in Matthew chapter 7, verses 15 and 16, "Beware of false prophets who will come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravenous wolves. You will recognize them by their fruits." It's easy to be deceived if we don't have wisdom or discernment. But Jesus says that we have the ability to separate the truth from what is false by analyzing the fruit. In other words, Jesus is telling us that we can recognize false teachers by both their character and the content of their teaching. But it will require some wisdom and discernment to do that. John actually gives very practical advice for this in 1 John 3 and 4. He refers to the character test and the teaching test. And I'll just show you his conclusions. 1 John chapter 3 and verse 10, he says, "By this it is evident who are the children of God and who are the children of the devil. Whoever does not practice righteousness is not of God, nor is the one who does not love his brother." The idea there is that if we can't trust somebody to be faithful to the Lord in their own character, then why would we think that we can trust them to be faithful to the Lord in the things that they say? But the second thing is that we can look at the teaching itself. And in 1 John chapter 4, verses 1 through 6, he begins by saying, "Beloved, do not believe every spirit, but test the spirits to see whether they are from God. For many false prophets have gone out into the world. By this you know the Spirit of God. Every spirit that confesses that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh is from God." What he's talking about here in these verses is that we have the ability to compare what we hear to what we know to be true. If we believe what somebody tells us simply because they've told us, then we're subject to believe anything. But if we compare it to what God has already revealed, if we listen to the word and we compare it to what is written, if we search the scriptures daily to see if the things that we're taught are so, then we will be able to know. We'll have the wisdom that we need to guard against false teaching and deception. And the third conclusion is that we need faithfulness against temptation and worldliness. We need to be among those 144,000 who have decided that we will follow the Lamb wherever he goes. And that means that we have to be serious about denying ourselves and the temptations that appeal to us. Jesus spoke about this in the strongest of terms. In Matthew chapter 5, he says, "If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. If your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. For it is better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body go into hell." Again, Jesus is talking about perspective. What is it in your life that means so much to you that you would trade heaven for it? What sin is so satisfying that you would trade fellowship with God to continue in it? We need to have the kind of devotion to holiness that Jesus talks about. We need to be people who are redeemed from the earth and its futile ways. You know, when we were in chapter 12, we talked about how the dragon has failed over and over again to overcome God and his plans. But just as he has failed to defeat the Messiah, he will also fail to defeat those who are loyal to him. And no matter which of Satan's allies that we're up against, whether it's persecution or false teaching or temptation, we need to remember the promise that's in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 13. 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 13 says, "No temptation has overtaken you that is not common to man. God is faithful, and he will not let you be tempted beyond your ability, but with the temptation he will also provide the way of escape that you may be able to endure it." There's always a way of escape. There's always an opportunity to choose faithfulness to the Lord. And God is faithful to us, and that's why we ought to be faithful to him. And so this is a call for the endurance of the saints. Let us keep the commandments of God and our faith in Jesus. Let's decide to live in the Lord, and let's decide to die in the Lord, knowing that when that day comes, it's rest from our labors that will follow. The question that is the all-important question is, are you in the Lord? What the New Testament teaches us is that it's by being washed in the blood of Jesus that we find fellowship with God, that we come into relationship with Him where our eternal future is secure. And so that's why we end all of our lessons with an opportunity to respond to the invitation of the gospel. As we sing this song, I hope that you'll consider whether you are washed in the blood. Are you in fellowship with Jesus? Have you obeyed the gospel of Jesus Christ? And for those of us who have already made that decision, let's think about our own faithfulness to Him. If there's anything that we need to repent of, let's do that. If we need to ask for help, let's do that. But if there's something that you want to make known, some need that you have the opportunity to share it with us before we leave. You can come to the front while we stand together and sing.